Hi, this is Elizabeth Lynch of ChinaLawAndPolicy.com, and welcome to our podcast. Today we are here with author Peter Hessler to discuss the release of his new book, Country Driving, A Journey Through China from Farm to Factory. This is the third book Peter has written about China. The first, Rivertown, tells the story of his 2 years teaching English in a small city in Sichuan, China. His second book, Oracle Bones, A Journey Through Time in China, was a 2006 National Book Award finalist and a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
My first question is just about your stay in China. You first arrived in China in 1996 to teach English in the Peace Corps, and you ended up staying there for 10 years. What is it about China that kept you there?
I mean, I guess it's a surprise to me because it wasn't a place I was interested in growing up. And when I was in high school and college, I certainly never studied Chinese or anything about Chinese history. And actually, when I was in college, it wasn't that common for people to study Chinese, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s. Actually, the first time I went to China was 1994. I was traveling. I finished graduate school in England, and I decided to go home to the East and take a long trip around the world. And I was really interested in seeing Eastern Europe and Russia. And then I was with a friend, we figured we'd continue into China and then go down to Southeast Asia. And really, I didn't have much interest in China, and I kind of hoped to get through China quickly in that trip. People who were coming the other direction said sort of bad things about it. It wasn't very easy to travel in, and it was, you know, and so it really wasn't a place I was looking forward to. And we took the train from Moscow to Beijing and arrived in Beijing, and I was really sort of blown away by the place. I mean, there was just a very tangible energy on the street. You could just tell that things were happening. People seemed motivated. You know, it was quite a contrast to what I'd seen in Russia, which at that time, this was in 1994, I found a little bit depressing. And so it really surprised me. And so I ended up extending that trip. I think my friend and I spent maybe close to 2 months total in China. We didn't speak any Chinese. You know, we're just bumbling through as backpackers, basically. But it really did grab me. And so then when I had always intended to apply to the Peace Corps, but this changed my plans in that I applied to the Peace Corps, but I really wanted to go to China. And I think that in the end, I mean, that sort of that energy that I sensed from the first week I was there was what ended up keeping me in China so long, you know. And when I did join the Peace Corps in 96, I had a sense that it might be longer than 2 years. You know, I really, because I had been there and because I knew that it's a big deal to try to learn a language like that and to try to understand a place like that, I knew it would take more than 2 years, basically, you know. And I wasn't surprised in some ways that it ended up being longer. I guess I wouldn't have expected it to be a decade. But there was never a time, you know, I never got tired of the place or, you know, felt like, you certainly never feel like you know everything. Mm-hmm. Because there's always, for one thing, everything's changing. So even if you did, by some miracle, know everything, it's going to be different next week. So, yeah.
So in your new book, Country Driving, a lot of your stories focus upon you driving around China, getting your driver's license, and the car plays a very significant role in your stories. How did you decide to focus on the car and driving in China? Was it a purposeful choice, or it was just how the story developed?
Yeah, usually when I do projects, I try to keep them very open-ended, and you know, I generally, actually with all my books, I've always written the book, and then I worked out a contract afterwards, so I don't like the idea of having to propose something before I do it, basically, mm-hmm. because you don't know what's going to be there, and I'd like to be able to respond to the material. Basically, this started as a magazine story. I was doing a piece of National Geographic on the Great Wall of China, and I decided I wanted to drive along the Great Wall, and I just sort of the trip became more and more ambitious as I was planning because I liked the idea of doing it. I thought it would be interesting. I had just gotten my license, and then that journey was just a great experience. I mean, it was probably the best trip I've ever taken in China. And after taking that trip, I started to think, you know, I would like to write about this in a book, but I really feel like there's these other issues I would like to explore. And one of the things I noticed when I was driving across is you go through all these little villages, you know, where people are leaving, and life is obviously really different from what it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. And I wanted to get a deeper sense of what that meant to people and how people responded to that. And around the same time, I was renting a house in Beijing, outside of Beijing in the countryside, partly for, mostly just for personal reasons, just because I wanted an escape from the city. But I eventually started writing about that place and how people cope with the changes. And then so as time moved on and I sort of had these two parts to the book I was thinking about, I realized, you know, I need also to give people a sense of where this is going. All these people are leaving villages, young people are migrating, they're going to these factory towns. I want to write something about a factory town as well and have this in the book. So, you know, I often for me, this is the way projects have generally developed, you know, and then you sort of feel your way along, and maybe you get to a point and you can sort of see the whole thing in the sense of what you need and what you'd like to do. And for me, that was at a moment when I said, okay, I want to go to a factory town and write about development there. And at that point, once I got into that last project, which was in Vichre, you know, that I could see that that would be the book, basically. But, you know, as far as the automobile, yeah, there was a link with all of them, because the first one was a driving trip that kind of gave me an introduction to the north and to some of these rural issues. The second journey was to a village where they didn't have a paved road when I started going out there and renting a house, and then eventually they paved the road. There was the car boom in Beijing, and, you know, this place responded very dramatically. You know, people's lives changed enormous ways. And then for the last section about the factory town, I chose a town in Zhejiang province that was along the route of a new expressway. Because I know that highways, this is the highway that linked them to the coast, that has a huge impact on you know, your local economy if you have a road that goes to the, you know, to a port.
And in terms of the first part of country driving, you described your drive along the Great Wall, and you go through a lot of these villages that are, they seem like they're just closing down, and they're mostly poor. You talk about them being depopulated, barren, no longer farmable, and you even talk about some of the aid work there that is subject to a lot of corruption. In your feelings, in your mind, what do you think is the future for these villages? If you go back 10 years from now, will they exist? What do you see for these villages?
Yeah, I mean, it was very striking because, you know, China has been in the midst of this incredible migration. I mean, most of the figures now are 130 or 140 million people have left the countryside, you know, mostly young people looking for jobs in the cities. And, you know, when I was traveling, I mean, it's amazing how, you know, this is the other side of migration. You've been to the factory towns or the cities where you see all of these people, but where are they coming from? You go to these villages, and I drive through, and you talk to people, and they would usually say the population has decreased by half, roughly. You know, that was generally the number I would get from talking to people. I never met anybody in a place who said, oh, we haven't lost population. It was every single town. And often it's really striking that you just do not see people in their late teens and 20s in these towns and 30s. You know, they're either older people, elderly, or you see disabled people, or you see small children, because children are still being raised by their grandparents often in these villages. So, you know, it was something as I drove that, in a way they are quite poor. They've always been poor, but they're very, you know, they're also incredibly open and friendly. I mean, I never had a single bad experience in these little towns, and people were incredibly generous. They would invite me in. They were totally trusting. So, you know, it did make me sad to think about that. These places are really changing, and I don't know who's going to be there in a generation. I mean, it is hard to envision who would, you know, why would somebody stay, basically. You know, and people often told me that. And along the way, I was picking up hitchhikers, which is mostly because I had an empty car, and I found that it was interesting, and most of those hitchhikers were young people migrating, you know, and you talk to them, and they said, there's no way I'm going back, you know, there's nothing there for me. So I don't know what happens. I think maybe eventually, if China reformed some of the land use laws, perhaps people would consolidate farms, and there would be some farmers who can make a better living because they have bigger holdings. You know, that's what should logically happen. It's, in some ways, it's not a bad thing because, you know, country, I don't know, when they started the reforms, they had like 900 million farmers or something in 78. You know, you don't really need 900 million farmers in a country. You know, it's sort of, it's inevitable that this is going to happen. And we've been through it. You know, Europe went through it. If you look at 19th century literature, there are all these poems, you know, English poems about villages that are dying and don't exist anymore, you know. So this is, you know, it's an old story in that sense. I think eventually you will see this sort of consolidation. There will be some people who remain as farmers. But for this particular moment, it is very hard to see the future.
Yeah. In terms of the law, you brought up some reform to land use laws. And in certain parts of country driving, I know that you mentioned just in passing the Chinese law and the legal system. Your neighbor in Sanchao, Wei Zichen, he holds on to contracts dating back to the Qing dynasty, showing that he should have title to certain lands. You describe how the law doesn't protect the countryside and allows cities to buy farmland at cheap prices and then just flip it at a very higher price. And you also discuss the petitioning system. And when you bring up these interactions with the law, it seems like the law itself doesn't really offer a solution for the people that you write about. Do you think this is changing at all? Do you see the law or the legal system developing in a way to protect these people? In the field I'm in, we hope that the legal system is changing to better protect a lot of these people, but on the ground, do you feel that that's really happening?
Well, there's like so many things in China. There's so many levels to this issue, and I think there's a huge amount of vitality and energy in the legal field right now in China. And if you go to like Tsinghua University or at the upper end, it's quite vibrant. There are a lot of people thinking very hard about these issues, working very hard on them. There's a lot of life to it. So I do think in that sense, it's clear that people are interested in making this a better system, no doubt. And I think that eventually it will happen. What for this book, I mean, really, my focus was much more on sort of working class people. A lot of these people were farmers. Basically, most of the people I'm writing about are people who are from the countryside but are making this transition one way or another to urban life or to being entrepreneurs. In the last section, people who are becoming factory workers or managers and so on. So I'm sort of seeing their perspective, which is going to be very different from a legal scholar. But it's interesting when even in these places, I mean, the people have a deep faith in law, really, and quite an interest. I mean, you mentioned Wei Zixi. I mean, this is somebody who had just about 8 years of formal schooling, but he's very bright. And when he was older and had been farming for a while, he took a correspondence course in law, for example, and he kept all of these books that he got from that course that taught him how to draw up contracts, for example. So when I, rented a house there, he wrote up a very formal contract and had me and the person I was renting with sign it, and had all these clauses. I mean, one of the clauses was that you can't store explosives in the house. I mean, really, really detailed stuff. And of course, it really had no legal status. I mean, you couldn't take that contract to court.
Yeah.
But he believed, to him it was important, and it showed sort of an interest in it and a respect for the law. So you do sort of see that a lot, I guess my characterization of how, and for him in the village, he was aware of certain laws. Like when he wasn't getting a certain fee that he was supposed to be getting, he would find some way to make sure he did. And he would say, the law's on my side. It was important to him. I think one of my general conclusions from watching how people interact with the law in places like this and in the factory town is that it's certainly not a fair system. And it's not a system that we would see as certainly being anything close to finished, but it's pretty functional, to be honest. I mean, it's and you mentioned the land use issues, which are really unfair to people in the countryside. But it allows development to proceed in the way that it has, and in some ways they're at a stage now. It's a weird stage in that there were huge problems clearly with the legal system, but it works, and the corruption even is sort of manageable. It's almost like there are rules to it, and people know how it works, and so their level of comfort is a lot higher than what you would expect. As an outsider, you think this is just it's a bad system. These things are wrong, and people shouldn't tolerate. But from their perspective, it's different. It's probably better. It's better than it was 20 years ago. And they also know basically how it works. They find ways to make things work in their favor. Now, what they do is not what we would expect. For example, in the factory town where I spent a lot of time, there was really very little sense of the law there. In the sense of, I never met a lawyer there. I never got any sense of anybody doing any kind of NGO work. There are no unions that I ever encountered. The government has an official union, and they would like show movies on the street to factory workers. That's the only contact I ever had with them. But it doesn't mean that people were powerless. It just meant that they didn't find recourse in the law specifically. If a worker had a problem, he didn't talk to a union. He didn't, call a lawyer. But he found other ways to do it. And I write, for example, about a family that works in a factory. And the things, I've watched them over a period of years. And for example, when they started working in the factory, they sent their youngest daughter with the older daughter's ID. The youngest one's, 15, barely 15 years old. She's not legal to work, but because she's the fake ID, she gets a job, and then she brings her sister in. And sooner or later, soon enough, the whole family's there. And they end up with quite a bit of power because they sort of had a network of six workers or so who are a huge part of the labor force. And they could negotiate as a group, And so people, it's a place where people have agency. The type of agency they have is not traditional. It's not necessarily legally based. So as an outsider, it's very hard to understand. But at the same time, you kind of respect it. When I watched that family, the Tao family, when I watched them negotiate, I mean, I didn't feel sorry for them. You know, they were really good at what they did. I would not want to negotiate with them. I wouldn't want to be the boss. I mean, I almost felt more sorry for the boss sometimes because they were just, they were really tough people, you know. So you sort of admire them, but again, you realize that, you know, it's not a finished system, but it's functional. So when you talk about corruption in China, it's not, you know, it's not Nigeria. It's not some country where you go and they just, you know, you try to set up a business and they set up a system of bribes that make it just completely impossible to function. It doesn't work like that. I mean, the other example I give in the book is when these guys are setting up their factory and the officials from the tax bureau came. I was sitting there and watched this whole interaction with these three officials came from the tax bureau. And they, you know, they were intimidating. They let the factory owners know that they were in control, and they sort of had this conversation, this very tense conversation. They said, "Well, you know," they're asking questions about the business because they're just starting business. They said, "Do you have an accountant?" And the bosses say, "No, we don't. We haven't started selling anything yet. So we'll get one eventually." They said, "Well, you should get an accountant." "Okay, you know, we'll get one once we start doing business." They said, "No, you should get an accountant now." And I have a friend who runs a business that has an accountant. And here's his card. And then the boss is like, "Oh, yeah, maybe we should get it. Maybe we should get an accountant now." And that's kind of the way it works. And then that interaction is over, and the guy makes a phone call and hires the accountant. And so you realize, like, it's not fair, but it works, you know? And it's not an onerous cost, in a way. And so he wasn't angry about it, you know? He's just like, "This is the way it is," you know? He's like, "And it's going to cost me 80, that was like 80, 90 bucks a month. No big deal. You know, he'll deal with it." So I think that's kind of the stage that they're at. You know, and they do have some huge questions that remain to be answered, and it's very hard to tell, especially that land use issue, which is that people in the countryside, you know, can't buy and sell their own land, you know, and that has been a huge problem over the years, and it continues to be. And there have been lots of signs and lots of discussions of reform, but it hasn't happened yet.
Right. In terms, when you were traveling through the countryside and the factory towns, you see a lot of people on the move. And you do see these inequities, but amongst the people themselves, what was their biggest gripe? I mean, was there focus? Because I think a lot of foreign NGOs that are in China, a lot of the work I do, there's a focus on the inequities in society or the environmental damage, things like that. But do you feel that people that are in these small, in the countryside and in the factory towns, what do you think is their biggest issue?
It's very localized. If you ask people, it tends to be corruption, and what they mean is the corruption of local officials. And that doesn't mean that the top levels aren't corrupt, they just don't see it, you know. So often they sort of continue to have a faith that the top levels of government are better run and the people are more honest. But the locals, because they know the locals, they see what's happening, they're very cynical about that. It is incredibly localized. I think one of the year that I wrote about, where I was following a dam project in this book, they reported something like 87,000 public disturbances, protests in China that year. And you sort of see these figures every year. It's a figure like that, close to 100,000. You think, my God, you know, the country's about to explode. But when you do sort of encounter one of these instances and look at it, it tends to be so incredibly localized, and it's not connected to larger issues. So you meet somebody in the countryside and you ask them what's wrong, and they won't tell you, you know, the land constitution, you know, just isn't fair in terms of land use laws. They don't, you know, and it's hard to have that kind of vision, you know. It's like they're not seeing these sort of huge issues. They're, you know, what they would tell you is, well, you know, my piece of land, I didn't get the market value for that piece of land. And that's really all that they're going to care about is their own situation right now. So you don't see people making these connections. I mean, you see some of the outsiders and some of the NGOs and folks like that are in different positions. But the people that are in the villages or the factory workers, you know, that's not their issue. And to be honest, it's such a demanding society. Everybody is coping with so much change. I often feel like they just don't have the energy to go after those big issues. They don't have, you know, you can't blame them. You know, they've got a lot of stuff to take care of. And, you know, Wei Dichi, he's trying to shift from being a farmer to being a businessman. He's joining the party in the local village. He's trying to get a solid political position in his village. He has all of these things to worry about. The last thing he's going to worry about is trying to reform the constitution. He has no way to do that, and it's just not going to be his natural response. So I sort of, you know, I think, again, this kind of contributes to the stability, basic stability that I see in China. Like, I think there are a lot of complaints, but again, it's sort of a pretty functional system, and I never feel like, my general sense is not that this place is about to explode. I guess I don't have that feeling. And I'm sort of going in more of a survey approach. Like, I don't look for problems and then focus in the sense, like, you know, in the village, I just went to a village and spent a lot of time there, and you see what happens. And the same thing in the factory town. I went to this factory town and spent a lot of time there. And so I noticed what type of protests came up. But I wasn't picking the biggest protests in the province, and then,
right.
You know, which really makes a big difference if you're a journalist or a social scientist. If you are, you know, look, in China's a big country, you can find anything you want, you know. And in some ways, I think this is a more representative approach in the sense of trying to just go to a place and see what's happening there in a normal situation. I noticed that there are a lot of protests. There was one significant big issue in the factory town, which was the new dam they were building.
Right.
But the response to that was not very threatening, really. People's anger was very localized. They weren't coordinated with any other kind of groups. It wasn't like they were, you know, linked up with other anti-dam groups in China. There weren't environmentalists down there. So it kind of makes me feel like the system is basically sustainable for right now.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of those issues, and in noting that there is some basic stability, and that there is, even though there are these complaints, they're very localized and they're not becoming a big issue. I mean, but if every rural area is having similar complaints, even though they're not unified, do you think that perhaps maybe China is not as powerful as the West right now currently views it? I mean, do you see this, even though it is a stable system, there is a lot of, I guess, tension on the local level. I mean, do you see this as problematic, and do you think the Chinese national government is going to deal with it in the future, or I guess, what do you see for the future?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's always a bad game to predict China's future, basically, but I think basically, I guess right now it's sort of a vogue to talk. We hear a lot more about how overwhelmingly powerful China is.
Right.
I tend to sort of temper that. I don't see China as on the verge of collapse, certainly. I've never felt that at all. But I also don't see it as this place that's, you know, an unbelievable juggernaut that's, they're doing everything better than everybody else is doing it, you know. So, you know, and it is like, you know, like I say, very, there's a lot of problems with the system. It's, you know, there are a lot of flaws. And you know, but there are still a lot of safety valves as well. One of the things I write about in this book is what happens to people who potentially could be dangerous, maybe, to the government, that who could cause a lot of trouble. When you go to the villages, and the really bright people, the ones who would probably be the most angry about injustices and also the most capable, you know, of fighting something or resisting something, they leave. They become migrants, you know, because they've got opportunities. So it's like a pressure valve. So you don't see the really bright young person staying in the village and stirring up trouble. That person's trying to find their way in the factory world. And that, so they've got a whole other series of challenges to go. They're outside of their home community. They don't have their networks anymore. So politically, they're not in a position to do a lot, you know. And in the village that I wrote about, the person I knew, Wei Jiqi, he's one of the very few really bright people who stay. And what happens to him? Well, he has some power struggles with local authority, but he ends up becoming a party member. He sort of becomes, to some degree, part of the local party power structure. And again, that, this also happens. People get recruited. So I think there are a lot of different pressure valves, basically, that sort of take some of the talented people out of the position where they would potentially cause trouble, you know. And, you know, it's sort of a hard thing because it can be very depressing in a way. Like when I was in that dam community and I met a lot of folks there who were angry and petitioning and bitter about it, and I noticed that they generally tended to be the lesser educated, they had the fewest financial resources, and this was, you know, partly because they were the ones who've been treated the worst, but they also were, I had to admit they were also some of the least capable of really doing something, basically. And the people I met who were capable were doing some, you know, were had either left or they were finding other ways to, you know, to make their way. Like there was one guy in that dam community who was really sharp. I mean, when he talked to me, he wanted to know what my journalist accreditation was. He had all kinds of questions about what kind of writing I do. He was the first one I met who was really sharp like that and really knew a lot of the issues, and his vision was much broader in the sense that, you know, he's like, they're moving people to these towns. There's nothing for them to do in these towns. You know, it's just, you know, they're just building these towns and there's no farming, there's no business, there's no factories. And then, you know, but he was well-dressed, he had a good cell phone. So I said, well, what do? How do you get your money? And he's like, well, I sell building materials in the towns that they're building. So it's like, he's profiting in a way, you know, he's found a way. And he's kind of hedged his bets, basically. Mm-hmm. But I just think there is still a level of opportunity that makes it hard for people to justify really you know, really devoting themselves to protesting. And I think eventually that changes, but you have to reach a point, in my opinion, where sort of the middle class, the upper class, the educated people, the ones with a lot of drive, when those people feel like they're getting really limited, and then because they have the tools, you know, and right now it's like the people at the bottom, I feel like, are the ones that really get hammered. And it's a very sad situation, but it's very natural in the sense that those are also the people who are the least capable of affecting massive political change, you know. And I think that'll, I think something will change with that. But I think it's going to have to be when this other group starts to see it as being in their interest to be a little less self-oriented and a little more, you know, aware of ways in which the system can be improved. And, you know, like I say, you have more and more energy going in this direction. I think it's going to take time. I've never felt like we're going to see a political change in the next 5 years or something, a major political change. I never had that feeling in China.
Okay. And on your road trip, as you were driving, were there any cities that you went through that reminded you of St. Louis or any other cities in the United States?
Yeah, I'm actually not from St. Louis. Like,
right.
In the middle. I'm trying to think. I mean, the cities are totally different, it feels like, in China. I mean, they always feel like they were just built, you know, yesterday.
Yeah.
Basically, a lot of these places, and especially when you're in the factory towns, because some of them were basically built yesterday. Mm-hmm. You can see them going up in front of your eyes. So it's a different world, I guess. I mean, yeah, and especially my driving trip I did, the first one was in the north, and the big city, I think the only really big city I passed through was Baltal in Inner Mongolia, which is just a weird place because they had a huge amount of money that came in there artificially from a government campaign, and just felt like a, you know, a huge metropolis in the middle of the desert. So they have a different feel, you know, and they feel like training grounds. I mean, everything's a trial, basically, in the sense that all the people have come in from the outside, the buildings have just been built, the streets have just been built, you know, people are having to, it's being figured out on the fly.
And what about when you were driving, did you have any driving music that you listened to or anything like that?
Yeah. No, I mean, I was on the road for days. I mean, it was, you know, more than, I guess I did two trips. This was in two parts. The first part of this book was, it was a journey in two parts, and each of them more than a month, you know, and that's a lot of time on the road. And I had, you know, good driving music, Bruce Springsteen and
that's
The
good.
Clash and a lot of rap music as well when I'm trying to stay awake and keep myself motivated. So it was, you know, it was very fun. I mean, I enjoyed it greatly. Also, I had no schedule, which helps. I think driving in China can be really tough if you have to go for like 8 hours a day or something. But I stopped when I wanted to. I tried to be careful so that I wouldn't get too tired. It was a blast. I mean, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, it definitely. It sounded like you had a lot of fun, especially on the trip through the with the Great Wall. But now that you're back in the States and you're now in Colorado, and country driving is out, what do you see that's next for you?
Yeah, I'm doing some projects in the States now where I'm researching things and a couple of things around where I live. I live in southwestern Colorado near New Mexico and Utah. So I've been pursuing some things there, which has been great. I mean, it's been nice to do a couple US-based projects and interview people in the States, which I haven't done for a long time. And so, you know, I'm shifting away from China for a while. And I think that my wife and I will probably be moving overseas again in about a year or so. And I think we'd like to study another language and live in another part of the world, write about someplace else. We're thinking about possibly the Middle East. We know that we'll go back to China eventually because we both really like it there. We're comfortable there. We still have a house north of Beijing in the village.
Right.
We felt like it's nice to do something different for a while. And for me personally, having this third book to me felt like the last, I felt like I was kind of closing a chapter in the sense that it was a great final project because I felt like I had all kinds of new challenges. I was putting together a lot of the knowledge I had learned over the full decade plus that I'd spent in China. And it felt like a natural stopping point. You know, I never wanted to reach a point in China where I felt like I was repeating myself or using the same type of story or same type of structure, same type of research, you know, projects over and over. And this to me was, you know, each of the three books feels quite different to me and they have different focuses. And so it was a good stopping point. And we'll be back, and, you know, at some point.
And
happy to do that.
Okay, well, I know for me and for, I'm sure, a lot of other people, if this is the closing chapter, a lot of us on your journey with China, a lot of us might be a little disappointed because you're one of, I think, the greatest writers about modern China. But I want to thank you for taking time to talk to us today. And just for our listeners, Country Driving comes out on February 9th and can be purchased at your local bookstore or on Amazon.com. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Thank you for talking to me.